for the first time. Just in case, this is our setting at the PFL. This is Geneva Lake. This is our campus. And Mont Blanc, it should be somewhere here. OK, so I'm going to talk today on scale invariant alternatives to general relativity. And my talk is based on a number of papers, which some of them are written quite a long time ago, 2 years ago, and a couple of papers are quite recent, and that were done together with Daniels and Hauser, Diego Blas, Juan Garcia Balida, and Xavier Rubio. So I start with a very trivial transparency, reminding you what general relativity is. So Einstein gravity is a theory which is invariant of all coordinate transformation, all diffeomorphisms. And this theory is a beautiful theory which passed all the tests of general relativity. And one of the main predictions of the theory is an existence of a massless dilaton, if we consider this theory from particle physicist point of view. There are some problems in GR which are not real experimental problems. These are mostly problems of fine-tunings. So the first one is a large dimensional full coupling constant, which is much, much larger than all the scales which we have in particle physics. And this difference between the Planck scale and mass of the Higgs or mass of the W lead to a famous hierarchy problem. Yet another fundamental parameter which appears in gravity is cosmological constant, and this parameter is a fundamental constant of this theory, and it's known to be extremely small. We don't understand why. And of course, what quantum gravity is remains to be seen. So, yes?
You say that TR is consistent with all experiments. It's only
consistent with galaxies, clusters, if you assume dark matter. Yes.
Which is not been detected.
Yes.
So it's not clear that
it's true. It could be still an open question. Maybe there is no dark matter at all, and there could be some modification of gravity. The problem here is that the modification of gravity, which will satisfy all our requirements, has not been built yet. But yes, that's one of the possible drawbacks. So what I'm going to discuss here, I'm going to discuss the following proposal. So I would like to replace the group of all coordinate transformations by a smaller group. And that will be TDIF, I will say in a second what TDIF, times dilatations. So TDIF are volume conserving coordinate transformations. So in GR, we have any transformation possible. But here, I will require that the transition from one coordinate, from one set coordinates to another coordinates, do conserve the volume. So determinant is equal to 1. And then I am adding another symmetry, which is a symmetry against dilatation. And this is a global symmetry. And say, in flat space-time, this symmetry would look will look like the following. You take any type of field. You multiply this field by some parameter to the power n, where n is canonical dimension of the corresponding field. And correspondingly stretch the coordinates. And this number n is called canonical dimensional of the field. And it is equal to 0 for the metric here, equal to 1 for scalars and vectors, and 3/2 for fermions. It simply coincides with the GV dimension of the corresponding field. And so what I'm going to argue is that this theory is consistent, or it produces the same, it passes the same tests as general relativity does, However, there are quite a number of differences. And here is a list of all these differences. So the first difference is that in this type of theory, all scales have dynamical origin. So they are not fundamental parameters like Planck constant, but they are dynamical. I will argue that hierarchy problem here gets a different meaning and an alternative to, say, supersymmetry, technicolor, little Higgs, or large extra dimension of this problem may be possible. I will also argue that cosmological constant problem will acquire a completely different meaning, different formulation. I will discuss that this theory leads to natural chaotic cosmological inflation. I will also show that this theory contains a massless new particle, dilaton, and in spite of the fact that this particle is massless, it's not rejected by any tests, by any searches for the fifth fourth. I will also argue that this theory contains dark energy without a cosmological constant, and I will say a little about quantum gravity. So my plan is the following. So first of all, I will remind you and tell you what I will be meaning about scale invariance, about classical scale invariance and this spontaneous background breakdown. Then I will introduce unimodular gravity and explain to you why do I want this feature from our theory. Then I will show that the requirement of scale invariance, unimodular gravity, how in this setup, cosmological constant, so to say, is put to zero, how this theory lead to inflation, and why it leads to dark energy. Then I will discuss quantum scale invariance. And finally, if I have time, I will show to you that dilaton in this theory can be considered as a part of the metric. Okay, so scale invariance. First, I'm going to start from an absolutely trivial statement. Suppose that we have some theory, and suppose that we multiply all mass parameters in this theory by one and the same number. And when I say all mass parameters, I mean all mass parameters. So for instance, mass of the W will be multiplied by this number. The gravity constant will be multiplied by this number. Lambda QCD multiplied by this number, et cetera, et cetera. So if this is done, then of course, physics is not changed. Why physics is not changed? Because what we are doing, we are measuring dimensionless ratios rather than absolute numbers. Well, this is a trivial statement. Why it's trivial? If we have in mind some Lagrangian field theory, then we can supplement this transformation by the stretch of coordinates, and then we will see that the Lagrangian of the system is not changed after this transformation is done. Sorry? It could be inverse of sim, but that depends on the type of the point of view. Okay, but yeah, if you want to see here minus one, I'm with you. Okay, this transformation, of course, is not a symmetry because once we apply some symmetry, the symmetry doesn't change the parameters of the symmetry. It does change the fields. And the analog the real symmetry we can talk about is the symmetry against dilatation. So what we are going to do, we are changing any field in this manner. So that's an equation which you have already seen. We multiply every field by the parameter to the power corresponding to canonical dimension of the field, and we stretch the coordinates. So if our theory is constructed in such a way, then it forbids all dimensional full coupling constant. It forbids the Higgs mass, a Newton gravity constant, cosmological constant, and everything, everything. Yes? It is a scale of the Lagrangian because, well, that's again the question of language. But in QCD, no. In QCD, if I take a quantum theory QCD, let me take just pure glue dynamics. Then lambda QCD is the parameter of this theory. And is what happens is that the coupling constant depends on energy through some equation, and in this equation, say alpha s is one over logarithm of some scale divided by lambda QCD. And from this point of view, lambda QCD is a parameter of this theory.
It's a parameter of the theory, but not Lagrangian.
Sorry?
It's a parameter of the theory, but not Lagrangian.
It's a parameter of the theory, and it is a parameter of Lagrangian because in quantum field theory, once you have a Lagrangian, this Lagrangian has divergences, and in order to fix all that, you have to specify prescription, and lambda QCD is there. But I afraid that this is just a question of terminology. Yes? Yes. I will not be
What's
talking about. I will not be talking about this type of while theories.
Is there any connection between?
It will be no connection at on this level. So while theory is a different theory, and I will not be discussing those. So I have a question though. Since I have 1 hour, how should I proceed? I'm happy to answer all the questions. So, but then.
Why don't we not heckle it, but we will
give
you extra time if there are lots of
questions. Okay. I'm not heckling, I'm asking a question. Okay, so at first sight, it seems that the theory which is scale invariant is ruled out by observations. Why? Simply because we do see different scales around us. We do see that the proton has a mass. We do see that the Planck constant is equal to some value. But in fact, it's not. And it's not if the dilatational symmetry is spontaneously broken. So what I'm going to do on the first stage, I will consider classical physics only, so no parameters like lambda QCD will be involved in my discussion. I will just discuss three explicit mass parameters, such as mass of the Higgs, mass of W, and the Planck constant. So let's ask ourselves, okay, we know that standard model is fine, so let's try to write down Lagrangian, which includes standard model, which includes gravity, and which is scale invariant, and which may have some chances to survive, which may fit experimental data. And then the Lagrangian, which would satisfy all these requirements, is written here. So what I'm doing, I'm taking the Lagrangian of the standard model, I put the mass of the Higgs equal to zero, because this is dimensional full parameter, which is forbidden by scale invariance. Then I add gravity action, which is written here. In gravity action, I'm not allowed to write Planck mass, because it breaks dilatational invariance. So instead, I'm writing here two fields. So phi field will be a Higgs doublet, and high field will be a new field dilaton, and you will see why the dilaton is needed in this setup. And then there is kinetic term for dilaton and some scale invariant potential, which includes two fields, the Higgs field and the high field, which I wrote in this somewhat unusual form, and you will see in a second why. So that's a scale invariant theory. So let's forget about gravity. for the time being, and let's discuss the choices of parameters in the particle physics part of this action. So here is the scalar potential. This is written in such a form because it produces me a flat direction along some line. And here is the term associated with dilaton and which breaks the degeneracy along this flat direction. So now, I would like to have a stable vacuum. And therefore, I should require that this constant is positive and this constant non-negative. If these two parameters are greater than zero, then the vacuum state is unique. And the high field is equal to zero, phi field is equal to zero, and scale invariance is exact. However, this is a theory which is not very interesting to me because of the following reason. If we have a scale invariant theory, and if the ground state of this theory is scale invariant, then we basically have two choices. If we assume that this theory contains particles or asymptotic states, then we can immediately say that this is a free field theory. How do we know? Well, this is known since long time ago. He has a proof of this theorem. But qualitatively, the argument is very simple. If you have asymptotic states, then the propagators of this theory should have poles. And since the theory is scale invariant, the only thing which you can write for the propagators of this theory is 1 over p squared for scalar and p slash over p squared for fermion. Now, if you have free propagators, then you can prove that your field theory is free. Free field theory is not interesting, and this is just then a very complicated way to write a free field theory. There is yet another option that there are no asymptotic states, and then we are coming to scale invariant field theory, which doesn't contain particles whatsoever. It contains some conformal waves, and though this theory may be mathematically consistent, it's not very much interesting from particle physics point of view. And therefore, the only choice, yes?
How do you know that this is complementary?
Yeah, yeah, this is quantum mechanically. That will be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm assuming this, this theory is a scale invariant not only on the classical, but also on the quantum side. And I will discuss this later on. I will show you how one can construct a theory which is quantum mechanically scale invariant.
But
that will be later on.
The previous slide you said you were just going to consider classical.
Yes. Yes.
This is not a free classical field.
No. Yes. 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 No. This is not a classical field. Now I'm jumped to the quantum, and then I will return to quantum somewhat later on. So if I Okay, let me repeat the thing. So I take this theory, take away gravity, then I have some Lagrangian. Let me assume for a second that this Lagrangian may have a sense as scale invariant quantum field theory. And if it does, then the only interesting choice corresponds to beta equal to zero. Because if beta is greater to zero, then my quantum field theory will or contain free particles, or it will not contain particles at all. Okay? And so for me, that's an argument to put in beta equal to zero. And if beta equal to zero, then the situation is changed. Why does it change? Because if beta is equal to zero, then our potential has a flat direction. And along this flat direction, we get non-zero vacuum excitation values for the Higgs field and for the dilaton. And in this background, we get all mass scales on the classical level. So for instance, we find that the Planck scale is not equal to zero, because the Planck scale will be proportional to the waves of these fields. And mass of the Higgs will be not equal to zero, mass of W. All fermions will get masses due to the presence of different condensates. Okay, now, in order to fit with observations, of course, certain choice of parameters must be made, and in particular, the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field must be much smaller than the vacuum expectation of Dilaton, because only this can lead us to a hierarchy between the Planck scale and the Higgs mass. And I have no idea from where this small number, which is needed from phenomenological consideration, can come from. Okay, so if gravity is away, and if scale invariance is spontaneously broken, and that happens only if beta is equal to zero, then I get a theory which can be phenomenologically acceptable. This theory, though, contains a massless field dilaton, but I will discuss this dilaton somewhat later. Now, a disclaimer that if gravity is included, then the argument which led me to the choice beta equal to zero is getting much weaker. So why does it get weaker? Because if beta is greater than zero, one can find a De Sitter solution. And if beta is smaller than zero, one can find in this theory an anti-De Sitter solution. And in both these solutions, the scales will be generated. So whether these solutions are good from a high theoretical point of view is difficult to say. People discuss different irregularities of De Sitter solutions. So for instance, De Sitter solution is not stable in the presence of massless scalar, and we do have massless scalar here. Or anti-De Sitter solution may have different pathologies, such as time, like closed loops, et cetera, et cetera. Whether this is important for that, I don't know. But what I'm going to do, I'm going to stick to this choice, beta equal to zero. It has more or less solid grounds for the theory where gravity is absent, and these grounds are not solid when the gravity is present, but I cannot say more about that. Okay, so I took this choice, beta equal to zero, and I would like now to see what happens in the theory. So it looks like we got the good news, because the cosmological constant is equal to zero. So along our flat direction, cosmological constant is exactly equal to zero. And that may be considered as a good thing. However, if cosmological constant is equal to zero, we are running in difficulties, because we do see that the universe is expanding with acceleration. And this may signal that the cosmological constant is there. And this leads me to another ingredient of the theory, which is unimodular gravity. So let me remind you what unimodular gravity is, and then I will explain to you why this change from general relativity to unimodular gravity can help in this situation. Okay, so in ordinary gravity, the metric g mu is an arbitrary function of space-time coordinate, and this is invariant under all coordinate transformations. And unimodular gravity, the metric, is also an arbitrary function of space-time coordinates. However, there is an extra constraint that determinant of g is equal to minus 1. And so this theory is invariant only on the transformation which conserve the four volumes. So this is transverse diffeomorphism theory. Unimodular gravity, in principle, is very interesting theory from the following point of view. If you approach gravity from the point of view of particle physicist, you can ask yourself, okay, I would like to construct a theory which contains a massless spin to particles. And I would like to have massless spin to particle so that this property is conserved if all quantum corrections or fold corrections are incorporated. You can address this question, and then you find that there are two theories which lead you to that. So the first one is general relativity, and the second one is unimodular gravity. Okay, so the number of physical degrees of freedom is exactly the same. So first, if you take unimodular gravity, you can say, aha, this is a great theory, and this theory I'm not going to get a cosmological constant. And at first sight, that seems to be true, because in GR, I can write this type of action, and of course there is a constant lambda here, which is a fundamental constant of the theory. So in unimodular gravity, this constant doesn't appear at all, because square root of minus g is equal to minus 1, and adding a constant does not lead to any change of dynamics. So it looks like that unimodular gravity solves the cosmological constant problem, but in fact, this is not the case. And the reason it's not the case is explained here. So if you take unimodular gravity, you can consider this theory as GR, adding to it a Lagrange multiplier, which is written here. So I introduce lambda x, which is an arbitrary function of x, and this is our constraint, one which is written in this peculiar form. Okay, so you can get this theory, then you find equations of motion. The equations of motion are written here, but now you take the first equation of motion, and you use the Bianchi identity, which tells you immediately that this Lagrange multiplier must be a constant. It doesn't depend on x and time. And that leads you to conclusion that the solutions of unimodular gravity are characterized by some new parameter lambda, and these solutions are the same as solutions of general relativity with non-zero constant of lambda. So on classical level, two theories are absolutely equivalent. However, the difference is that in general relativity, lambda is the fundamental parameter, whereas in unimodular gravity is an integral of motion related to initial conditions. However, what is very interesting is that quantum matter fluctuations, in fact, do not contribute to lambda if we are coming to quantum field theory. And from this point of view, the unimodular gravity, there is no need to fine-tune quartic divergences. And so let me explain you why. So if you take unimodular gravity, then the equations of motion of unimodular gravity look like that. So the left-hand side is different from what we would have for Einstein theory. And right-hand side contains only a part of energy momentum tensor, which is transverse, which is traceless, sorry. And so what happens is that the part of T mu, of which is proportional to G mu, does not gravitate. Okay, and in principle, that's a great thing. And however, by this lambda is much smaller than M Planck to the fourth, it's not addressed here. Okay, however, what I've done, I started from a theory which is scale invariant. And now I would like to unify these two ideas. The idea of scale invariance, the scale invariance itself, it helps to solve a cosmological constant problem, just because the cosmological constant is not admitted in scale invariance. And if you take unimodular gravity, then in unimodular gravity, the cosmological constant has a different meaning. So maybe we can use these two weapons to make the cosmological constant somewhat cosmological constant problem somewhat different. And so let's see what is going to happen. You have scale invariance and unimodular gravity. So we start from scale invariant theory. And now the gravity in our theory is unimodular. And so let's try to see what is going to happen there. So you can prove also an equivalence theorem as it was a theorem for unimodular gravity. So you can prove that the solutions of scale invariant unimodular gravity are the same as solutions of scale invariant general relativity with the action. And what you do, you add to this action a new parameter lambda. Okay? So now, the interesting point here is that this new parameter, which you introduce in scale invariant theory, is not a cosmological constant. So it's a constant, but it's not cosmological constant. So how do you see that? If in scale invariant theory, there is no Planck scale, and so interpretation of this theory is most easier in another frame, which is called Einstein frame. So by the way, the Lagrangian which I've written here is written in the frame which is called Jordan frame. So when you go from Jordan frame to Einstein frame, you are doing conformal transformation. And after this transformation, you find that the Lagrangian of your scale invariant theory, it contains an ordinary Einstein term, which is written here. Then it will contain some, do you have a pointer? Because I guess mine, my laser stuff doesn't work anymore. So it has some complicated kinetic term, but what is, thanks a lot. And what is most interesting for us is that it contains a potential which is now modified. So this is the part of the potential which is not associated with lambda at all. And then this is an extra piece which is now proportional to lambda. So the physical sense of our new parameter is not cosmological constant, but is the strain of some very peculiar potential of the Higgs field and of the dilaton. So here is the picture of this potential, and it's kind of very interesting. In this direction, you have a Higgs field, and in this direction, you have a dilaton. Now, and you see that if all the fields like Higgs field and dilaton field are pretty large, then this term related to lambda is gone, and you get a constant, okay? Whereas when the fields are small, then you get some singularity. And then depending on the sign of this singularity, you or have a peak here at zero values of your fields, or you have some singular behavior, some minus infinity of this potential when these two fields are small. Okay, and so what I'm going to argue now, since, okay, lambda is kind of fixed by initial condition, this is integral of motion, then if lambda is smaller than zero, then the cosmological behavior of this system will be first associated with inflation and later with some collapse in the state which we don't want to be. And with 50% chances, if lambda is greater than zero, we get this type of potential, and then the cosmological behavior of the system will be as follows. You start from somewhere here, then you go in towards this value, and this process leads to inflation. Then you're going back then you are coming back to this value which goes in this direction, and that leads to the reheating of the universe, heating of the universe. And when you run along this value, you get accelerating expansion of the universe. Okay, so the first part, yes.
When you say heat, you mean a standard model?
Yes, I mean the standard model.
Okay. So are you going to show that it's got a, because the like, standard model of particle masses or something like that? It's not clear to me how you get particle masses.
Yeah, particle masses you get exactly in the way as it is. This is like, I took the Lagrangian of the standard model. So there is nothing.
But there was no coupling of phi.
Yeah, there is. Well, I do take the Lagrangian of the standard model. So Higgs has coupling to anything which it must have. So this is standard model plus gravity plus new field dilaton, nothing else. And Lagrangian of the standard model is the Lagrangian of the standard model. No, the Higgs potential is... Well, the Higgs potential I showed, it's this is the Higgs potential.
Okay.
Yeah, and phi is the Higgs, lambda is the Higgs coupling constant. There is some new field, dilaton high, and this constant is very, very small because the wave of dilaton is much, much larger. Otherwise, it is their standard model. Yes? Yeah, I will answer later. Yes. Yes. Standard model is scale invariant at the classical level when the mass of the Higgs is equal to zero. Mm-hmm. And I will explain to you how to make it completely scale invariant. Okay. So first, I start with inflation. And with inflation, I would imagine that we have some chaotic initial conditions. So my system is somewhere here, okay, far away from the origin. Basically, it doesn't matter where it is. I will choose these two parameters. And I remind you that Xi H was a non-minimal coupling of Higgs to reach a scalar, and Xi High is non-minimal coupling of the dilaton to reach a scalar. So this guy I take to be much larger than one, and this guy I will take to be much smaller than one, and you will see why I've chosen this, the parameters in such a way. So if this parameter is much larger than one, then the behavior of the Higgs field is more essential. And one can show that at the initial state, the dilaton field can be fixed to be a constant. Okay, so imagine that you have just the standard model. Forget about inflaton fix. Forget about dilaton field, and consider very large values of the Higgs field, which is coupled non-minimally to gravity. So I will just denote this value by M Planck, and I will study the behavior of the Higgs field itself. Yes?
This may be a new question, but and so in unimodular gravity, the couple of constant, you know, the trace of this potential you don't see. So why is it that you see the trace of the potential by time?
Yes. Okay. It's true that in equation for unimodular gravity, okay, the right hand side is traceless. Okay. However, there is also a theorem which says that any solution in which you have in unimodular gravity there is a corresponding solution in the Einstein gravity. So first of all, there is no contradiction. And in unimodular gravity, you can find the exponentially rising solutions. Okay. So here, what is done here? Here, what is done is the following. You start from unimodular gravity. Okay. Then you find a theory of normal gravity, which has exactly the same solution. And then the theory is exactly the theory which I wrote here. Okay, and after transformation to Einstein frame, that's what you find. So this is a new parameter, but otherwise you analyze this theory exactly in the same way as you would do is normal general relativity. Because here, in this point, it is the normal general relativity. Oops. Okay, so what you do, you again make a transformation from Jordan frame to Einstein frame. This is again done by conformal transformation. And the action in Einstein frame, it has this form. Okay, so this H tilde is a new scalar field, which is related to the Higgs field. And the relationship is written here. That's a non-linear relationship. And here is the potential for the Higgs field of the standard model. There is nothing else. Dilaton is fixed to, to its value in the Einstein frame. So if the Higgs field is relatively small, then you get a potential coinciding with the potential of the Higgs field in the standard model. However, for large scalar fields, the potential is flat as it should be, and as I showed you in the previous picture. Sorry?
What is omega?
Omega. Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, it's not written here. Omega is omega square is 1 plus psi pi square over m prime square. This is just a conformal factor which stays in front of R. Okay, so you get a potential in Einstein frame, which is flat here. Okay, and once you have flat potential, you know that it may lead to successful inflation. And since you have here just one field, you can analyze this inflation by the use of the standard methods, finding slower roll parameters, and using Kolbe normalization. And well, what is interesting here is that the Kolbe normalization, it leads the relation to the relationship between non-minimal coupling and the Higgs mass. So if Higgs mass is of the order of 100 GeV or so, then non-minimal coupling, which is required for successful inflation, must be pretty large, about several thousand. You can see what are the predictions of inflation here. And the predictions are written here. This is the index associated with scalar fluctuations. And this is the gravitational waves. So what is predicted is that ratio R is very small, whereas NS is here, which is well inside the different measurements which were done at WMAP. Yet another point, which is non-trivial and which is interesting here, is that there appears the relationship between the Higgs mass and inflationary indices. So why it appears? Because this is the Higgs of the standard point. So what is shown here is the Higgs mass, and here is behavior of the spectral index as a function of the Higgs mass. There are several ways how this computation can be done, and these ways do depend on the way which you renormalize, in one renormalization prescription. The NS basically doesn't depend on the Higgs mass, but inflation can only happen if the Higgs mass is greater than 126 GeV. In another prescription, there is some dependence here. So I can clarify this point if there are questions, but this I have no time. I would like to show you these numbers. I would like to show them particularly because last year there was a seminar at CERN which announced some evidence of the Higgs in the region of 125-126 GeV. Okay, and this number appeared several years before this observation has been made. So let me tell you from where the Higgs mass appears and the inflationary scenario. The Kolbe normalization gives us the relationship between lambda and xi square, where xi is non-minimal coupling. And at first sight, the value of the scalar self-coupling is absolutely irrelevant. We can do inflation with any value of it. However, it's not the case because lambda itself depends on the scale. And in order for inflation to happen here, you must have that your theory is a valid effective field theory up to inflationary scale. Okay, so there are no any pathologies. In particular, the coupling constant lambda should be positive and it should not go to infinity at some scale. And the condition for that is written here. Okay? So if the Higgs mass is smaller than this value, then the scale of self-coupling gets negative at some scale, which is below inflation scale, and then the whole mechanism doesn't work. Whereas if the Higgs mass is larger than this value, then you get a Landau pole at some energies which are smaller than the than the Planck scale. Okay, and so if we are in between these two numbers, then everything what I told is self-consistent. Okay, and this number, which CERN see, is amazingly close to this. It appears in the following way, and this is absolutely amazing. So you know all parameters of the standard model, right? And so you don't know only what the Higgs mass is. Okay, so here there's your energy scale, and here is lambda. The behavior of lambda, it is in between this. So this type of behavior of lambda corresponds exactly to MH equal to 126 GeV. Okay, an absolutely outstanding and amazing fact here that if you fix the Higgs mass equal to this number, run it without knowing nothing about gravity, you find out that this behavior happens at mu equal to M Planck. Okay? And this point corresponds to lambda equal to zero and beta lambda equal to zero. So here, constant is equal to zero and derivative of equal to zero. So I believe this is an indication that the electroweak symmetry breaking must be related to the Planck scale. Sorry? That's how I explain. So if the mass is larger than this number, then the behavior will be like this. If the mass is smaller than this number, then the behavior will be like that. Okay? If the mass is smaller, then what happens is that at some point, the coupling constants start to be negative, and that means that electroweak vacuum is unstable, and that means that the theory is not self-consistent below the Planck scale, and so inflation doesn't happen. And this number 175, it occurs in this way. So at this point, the scalars of coupling get a Landau pole. Okay, and it gets a Landau pole at the Planck mass. If the Higgs mass is larger than that, it will get a Landau pole at smaller mass. And that means, again, that the standard model is not so consistent below the Planck scale. And therefore, everything what I said doesn't make sense. So only in this window it works.
CMS data shows three points. There's one at 190 GeV, which is too.
Which that would be too low. Similar. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what,
well,
what happens if it turns out?
Okay.
There's 190 GeV.
Okay, so here there are several uncertainties in all these numbers. And there are two certain sources of uncertainties. There is the first source of uncertainty is related to the experimental errors in top quark mass. Okay, and experimental errors in top quark mass roughly mean 2 GeV, 1 sigma uncertainty in this number. Okay, 2 sigma means 4 GeV. Then there are theoretical uncertainties. And this theoretical uncertainties are related to the following. When you run this coupling constant, you can use renormalization group equations with n number of loops. Okay, so now only 2 loop evolution equations are known. 3 loop are not known, and that introduces some uncertainty. Yet another uncertainty is that to know the behavior of this coupling, you should fix its initial value. And this is also perturbative computation, which can be done within 1 loop, 2 loop, et cetera, level. And so at the moment, it's done at 1 loop level. It should have been done at 2 loop level, but it was not. And that introduced yet another uncertainty, which is difficult to estimate, but which may run from 0 to 5 GeV. Okay, so. Though there is 0.3 here, there are uncertainties which are certainly few GeV.
The Higgs vacuum becomes unstable, which approaches 150 GeV.
We don't know yet.
It's marginal.
So it's we cannot say yet. We should do a computation one loop higher order, and we should measure the top quark more precisely to be really certain what this number is. Yes?
Your potential has 3 quark coupling, so why are you interested in the Higgs quark coupling?
Yeah, it has another coupling alpha, which was related to dilaton, if you're talking about this. But this coupling was extremely small and is absolutely irrelevant for this consideration.
So that
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'm on the half through, and I spend 1 hour. What I will do, I will accelerate. Okay. Let's discuss now dark energy. So inflation happens. Yeah, by the way, here, since the coupling of the Higgs field to everything in the standard model is known, the way how universe heats up after inflation can be computed. Okay, and you find that the temperature at which the universe starts with Big Bang is pretty large, about 10 to the 13 GeV. So what happens after that? Our system comes into, it's trapped into this valley, and it continued to run. And so in spite of the fact that asymptotically the value of energy is equal to 0, otherwise it's not equal to 0, and that leads to accelerating expansion of the universe. So how can you compute that? Once you get trapped into this plateau, you are again coming to the regime when only one of the scalar fields is essential. And now it is dilaton, which is essential. You can find the potential of dilaton in this case. Quite amazingly, you will get an exponential potential which first appeared in works of Vettori, Rather, and Peebles when they discussed dark energy a long, long time ago. And so this type of potential may lead to accelerating expansion of the universe from observed equation of state, one gets that this parameter xi should be much smaller than one. And that's the reason why I have chosen the coupling of the Higgs field to R being strong and coupling of the dilaton to R being weak. Okay, I will skip this part. So previously, I had a discussion with one field, another field. One can bring two fields together and make more detailed analysis. I will just show you one figure which appears here and which gives a relationship between equation of state of dark energy and inflationary indices. Okay, so how this relation appears. So this minimal is extremely minimal model which doesn't introduce many new particles and which doesn't introduce many new coupling constants. And therefore, fixing inflationary parameters, you can out of there fix the equation of dark energy. And here is what appears here. So this is 1 plus omega dark energy. This is a deviation of equation of dark energy from minus 1. So minus 1 would correspond to a cosmological constant. And this is the scalar index. And there is this type of dependence. Okay, so this is a WMAP region. And from here follows that the equation of state should be very close to minus 1. And in principle, that's a very non-trivial relationship because it just happened in this way. It could be in some way which would completely reject this theory. Okay, so what I will do, an intermediate summary, and then I will discuss briefly the question of quantum scale invariance because there were many questions. Okay, so if we have spontaneously broken scale invariance, then all mass scales originate from one of the same source. This is the vacuum expectation value of the dilaton. So if the zero of cosmological constant is related to the choice of parameter beta equal to zero, which in the absence of gravity was a requirement of presence of particles in the theory. Scale invariance leads to flat potentials and thus to cosmological inflation, whereas unimodular gravity in this type of theories leads to a new parameter, which is not cosmological constant, but the strength of some particular potential, and the evolution of dilaton field leads to dynamical dark energy in spite of the fact that cosmological constant is equal to zero. Okay, so quantum scale invariance. So common lore is that quantum scale invariance does not exist. So if you take dilatational current and find the divergence of dilatational current, then one normally finds that it's not equal to zero and is proportional to corresponding beta functions, which describe running of the different coupling constant. So this is a quotation of Sidney Coleman. For scale invariance, situation is hopeless. Any cutoff procedure necessarily involves a large mass, and large mass necessarily breaks scale invariance in large way, and leading to a conclusion that there is no point to discuss scale invariant theories on the quantum level. Well, of course, there are exceptions, like n equal to 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills, but they are far from being realistic. And so if we take these statements for granted, we should arrive to conclusion that everything what I was doing here for 1 hour doesn't make any sense. So let me show you how to overcome these conclusions and how to construct the quantum field effective theory, which is invariant in all orders of perturbation theory. So for this end, let me remind you how the breaking of scale invariance appears in quantum field theory. So for instance, in dimensional regularization scheme. So what you do in dimensional regularization, you say that your theory is formulated in a number of space-time dimensions, which is different from 4 minus 2 epsilon. So if you formulate a theory in fractional number of dimensions, then you find out that in this number of dimensions, the scalar self-coupling or all other couplings are in fact dimensional full. Okay, so mu is a Tooth Weldman parameter, and epsilon is deviation of dimensionality of space-time from 4. Okay, though formally, when epsilon goes to 0, this disappears, but this is compensated by the fact that in quantum field theory, there are divergences. These divergences comes at length 1 over epsilon, and expansion with respect to epsilon is non-trivial, and it leads to overlapping of mu and divergences. And if you apply this type of procedure to theories which are scale invariant at the classical level, you find that scale invariance is broken. Okay? It's explicitly broken by renormalization. And if you take the theory which I started with initially, and consider the behavior of dilaton field along the flat direction, then we will find that, okay, that this flat direction is now spoiled, and our potential acquires non-zero, it acquires some slope. The dilaton wave is fixed, dilaton mass is not zero, et cetera, et cetera. And then everything is broken. What is the key point of this construction? The key point of this construction is that here we are dealing with renormalizable theories. And the statement that once you take renormalizable theory, regularize it, and do your computation, then you inevitably break the scale invariance. However, if we have a theory, say, with gravity, then the theory is not renormalizable. And whether the requirement of renormalizability has to be chosen, it's an open question. And so here is the construction which takes away the requirement of renormalizability, and that leads you to a possibility to have scale invariance in your theory. So what is the, why it didn't work for the standard regularization procedure. Because in any number of dimensions different from 4, the coupling constant, bare coupling constant, and renormalized coupling constant, they were different in dimensions. Okay. Now, when you regularize your theory, you can compensate or you can reintroduce the dimension of the coupling constant, not only by introducing an extra parameter mu, which was the case previously, but using the fields which are already in your theory. So imagine that you replace mu there in the previous formulas by some function of the scalar field. Once this is done, then your theory is scale invariant in any number of dimensions. Okay. It is regularized completely because the number of dimensions is not equal to 4, and it is scale invariant there. Now, if you do computations now in this theory and throw away all poles 1 over epsilon, you automatically get a theory which is scale invariant in all orders of perturbation theory. However, this theory.
It's not a theory, it depends on
U is in the Fourier space and chi is in the real space. So how can you chi is the field defined in the real space and U is the cutoff.
No. In dimensional regularization, what you do, you can write your Lagrangian in X space, and you simply replace lambda by lambda 0 mu to the power epsilon. That's it. And then you apply all these ordinary rules. Okay? So this type of regularization was first introduced quite a while ago, and we kind of rediscovered it. Okay, there is a very important point in this construction, which is related to the fact that this construction is perturbative. Okay, this particular construction is based on dimensional regularization. And moreover, it can only be used if we have spontaneous breaking of scale invariants. So we need a non-zero background of the field high. If there is no non-zero background of the Higgs phi, the perturbation theory cannot be applied because you cannot make expansion with respect to small high. But if high is equal to some constant, then you can do the perturbative expansion. I will skip an example of computation which shows how you do that in one loop and that indeed the scale invariance remains intact. By the way, origin of QCD. How QCD parameter appears here. So one could say, if there is a scale invariance, then the coupling constants do not run. Okay, and since we know experimentally that they do run, this is all, this doesn't work. So that's not, in fact, the case. And to understand why it's not the case, you can see what is the running of different couplings here. So for simplicity, I can consider, say, Higgs-Higgs scattering. And then in the tree approximation, the Higgs-Higgs scattering will be given by this graph. And in one loop, you will get this contribution. Now, once you use this new renormalization scheme, then this contribution will be lambda square. So this is lambda. Lambda doesn't run. It's a constant. But this contribution here will be lambda square, and here it will be logarithm s divided by chi zero, where chi zero is the wave of the dilaton. Okay. Now, when you resum these corrections, you find out that the cross section completed from this exactly coincides with the cross section you would do in a normal renormalization prescription, and lambda QCD is given by the wave of the dilaton times some exponential, which contains alpha strong, which doesn't run. Okay. So as I already said, this theory is not renormalizable, so that.
Cross sections, and it's a free parameter in Lagrangian.
Yes.
But here it is no longer.
It's no longer true, but it leads to the same result. Okay. There is the very, thank you, Jan, for this question. There is a very important difference. So if I have renormalizable field theory, then doing this resummation, I can potentially find my cross section at any energy. Well, if we forget about Landau poles. Here, this is not the case because there are power-like corrections which are suppressed by the dilaton field. And once the energy is of the order of wave of the dilaton field, of the order of Planck scale, the perturbation theory completely breaks down. Okay, so that's the main difference. Uh, okay. So, and that's basically the this comment that this is not a renormalizable theory, and we don't know here what is the behavior at high energies that requires resummation or whatever. Yes, now let me come to dilaton, because this is an essential point. So since we have exact scale invariance, then the dilaton is massless in all orders of perturbation theory. And you may think that that will introduce the fifth fourth. And I'll finish and then I'll then introduce the fifth fourth. And there are very strong constraints on the fifth fourth, which may rule out that. So amazingly, this is not the case here. And why it's not the case here? Because dilaton is a Goldstone boson of spontaneously broken symmetry. And that means that it only has derivative couplings to matter. And once it has derivative couplings to matter, no constraints on the fifth fourth are applicable to this particle. Okay, and I think I will completely skip this part. Yes?
If you had the scale invariant theory, you needed more than just, if you had the objection which said that, supposing you just grant that quantum effects are scale invariant, you need, the other thing you need for the spontaneous breaking is this flat direction. And that was, I guess, beta equals zero here. So one of his objections was that what stops radiative corrections that preserve scale invariance from still lifting that flat direction and giving you only a minimum at the scale invariant point? So is beta equals zero in the curse table under radiative corrections?
Sorry, I'm not sure I got your question.
The scale invariance is very attractive because it gives you a flat direction.
Yes.
And then one point in that flat direction is the scale invariant point where all the fields are zero.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't like that point because everything is zero, including all the masses. So the thing is, what you want is a flat direction where you're not at the scale invariant point, but you're still tied to zero because everything's related by scale transformations to the symmetry, right? And so his objection was that what stops you having a radiative correction, which is scale invariant, but which lifts the flat direction, just leaves you the one minimum at the like
yeah, yeah.
Five
okay.
Fourths.
Nothing.
So
of course.
Mean,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Zero.
Okay. That's a very good question. So the question was, okay, once we take this scale invariant theory, and we use scale invariant prescription, does it automatically guarantee that we keep the flat direction intact? The answer is no. So this computation of corrections, well, first of all, when you compute these corrections, you have a level of arbitrariness. That depends on the way how you introduce your counter term. And there are always finite parts, okay? The statement is that you can always fix finite parts of counter terms in such a way that this direction remains intact. Okay? With arbitrary choice of the finite parts, the direction can be broken in this way or in that way. However, if the finite part of counter terms are such that it stays like this, then you're coming to a theory which doesn't have which has only free particles or doesn't contain particles at all. If it breaks in this way, then you get a theory which is not defined. Okay, so to put it in other words, the effective beta constant, which is a beta in all orders of perturbation theory, must be equal to zero. Otherwise, you are not going to get theory which is phenomenologically acceptable.
Does that mean that if I just take your theory as you gave it,
yes. It will be zero only if you add specific finite counter term.
And that would be part of the definition of your
yes,
theory.
But this is part of the definition of the theory. Yes.
So, since I stopped you, can I ask you one more question? So I remember back in the 80s there was a discussion in the literature about making scale invariance and exact symmetry and not having an anomaly dimensional regularization, much like you're saying, but it did not involve new fields. It was just basically doing everything and staying in the deep dimensions rather than taking a hard limit to four dimensions. Is your mechanism essentially the same mechanism, or are the fields playing really an important role making a difference?
Okay. There was a discussion which started from Englert and other papers, where they introduce essentially the same scheme of renormalization, and where they discuss the question whether gravity can be made conformally invariant. Okay. But to the best of my knowledge, there were no really discussion of the scale invariance here in this respect.
Duff and company had this
exactly. So Duff and company, they said that, okay, what was done by Englert and others, in fact, doesn't apply to conformal invariance because there are some other finite terms which appear and which break this construction. So here I would like to stress that the theory I'm talking about is not conformally invariant. Certainly not. It is scale invariant, but it's not conformally invariant. And so this previous discussion somehow doesn't apply to
so this is a different thing. Mechanism.
Yes, it's a different mechanism. Okay, well, I think that, yes, I should stop here. I'm not going to discuss dilaton as a part of the metric. And here are my conclusions. Thank you.
The hydrogen atom, the vacuum polarization energy of hydrogen atom gravitates.
Yes.
So if you say it's zero, you can show that you violate the equivalence principle significantly.
No.
This was done by Joe Polchinski.
No.
It's correct.
Well, the
This is a consequence of the
logic. Yeah, okay. The statement which comes out from here. If you take unimodular gravity, scale invariant, etc., then this theory is equivalent to Einstein gravity plus one extra particle. So if you take away this extra particle, then this theory respects equivalence principle exactly in the same way as general relativity does. Okay, so the only source for breaking of equivalence principle is the appearance of dilaton here. However, this new particle, which is massless and which would potentially lead to violation of equivalence principle, it does lead to it, but in so weak way that it's certainly not seen in experiments. And the reason for that, because this is Goldstone-Bose and it has various weak
coupling. Quantum fluctuations don't contribute to the logic, right?
Yes.
So this means the vacuum polarization energy of the hydrogen atom doesn't contribute. It doesn't gravitate. Because the fluctuations are zero. Then we can show in that case that the weak equivalence principle is violated to 6 orders of magnitude.
But since there is an equivalence theorem between this and gravity, if this statement is applied to this theory, then it must be applied to Einstein gravity as well.
So the standard model Lagrangian Hamiltonian is in the Jordan frame with square B. And then you perform a theory definition to Einstein frame to find the potential general population. But at the same time, you will generate a other coupling between the standard model field with this dilaton and this. So this is not the standard model anymore because by going to Einstein frame, you change the level.
Yeah, but yes, it's not a standard model anymore at NHS, which are of the order of the Planck scale. Okay, so all low energy region is absolutely identical. So you can consider. You take a standard model. In any way, there are some high-order corrections or high-order operators which should be added to it. So this theory provides a way to fix a number of higher-dimensional operators in a particular way. Yep.
After the dilaton gets a bit, why is your Higgs not requiring the mass of the vacuum?
Mm-hmm. Okay. You can show that if you use a scale invariant regularization, such as dimensional regularization, then the web of the Higgs field, web of the dilaton field, only appears through logarithms. It never appears as high to some power.
But don't you have terms in the Lagrangians that are just
yes.
give you a bare mass term?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But these terms are suppressed by 1 over high 0. So
because you have small coupling.
Yes, yes.
But then doesn't this small coupling get renormalized? Like, don't you have to tune that small coupling?
Yes, it's renormalized logarithmically. And if it's
but then at some level you have to tune that coupling, right?
No, no. Yeah, that's... it's a very good point, and so that's this is the potential which we have. So first, you see that if you put alpha equal to 0, this mixing between this guy and this guy, then these two fields completely decouple from each other, okay? That's the first point. And second point is that the parameter high zero only appears in a way as mu appears in dimensional regularization, okay? Now, you know that in dimensional regularization, the parameter mu only comes through logarithms. You never get that. And so in the limit when alpha equal to zero, you get high zero only through logarithms, so these are correction to the Higgs mass. Now, there are terms which are proportional to alpha. And then since when alpha is equal to zero, you get a new symmetry in this theory, which is the symmetry of shift of the high field. Dimensional regularization also conserves this symmetry, and that means that the corrections are proportional to alpha, and alpha is small. Okay, so this proof, it uses particularities of dimensional regularization, and it can be applied there. If some other regularization is used, it may not go through.
But related to that, isn't it true that what you're saying is right, but it's if you had had another, supposing you added another, the assumption is there's nothing else apart from what you wrote down. So if you added a heavy field that had a recoupling coupling to the field that got a big fab and integrated it up with potential regularization, then that would be a big fab.
Yeah, that's also a very good point. The very important point of this construction is that it assumes that standard model plus gravity is everything what exists in nature. Once any heavy field is added to the theory, then all troubles related to hierarchy problem return. So for me, that's a good argument which shows that there should be no any heavy particles between electroweak scale and the Planck scale.
But the dimensional regularization is blind to protractive divergence. If you use another regularization scheme, then the protractive divergence Higgs loop does contribute.
Yes.
Higgs mass hierarchy.
Exactly. But
it's dangerous just to use dimensional.
Absolutely. Other type of regularization, such as cutoff regularization, they must not be applied here because they explicitly break scale invariance, and requirement of keeping scale invariance was the key point of this construction.
Can you accommodate neutrino masses?
Yes. Yes, for this. The extension of the theory which I like most and which I worked on is that you have to add three right-handed neutrinos. But the masses are smaller than electroweak scale. Okay, so if you introduce these particles with masses smaller than electroweak scale, you don't have problems with hierarchy. At the same time, one can show that these particles can explain simultaneously neutrino masses, bear on the symmetry of the universe, and dark matter.
So you don't use a seesaw mechanism?
No. Well, there is a seesaw, electroweak type of seesaw mechanism, but not at the unification. So the theory, then a theory, okay, which solves neutrino masses, baryonic symmetry, and dark matter. So this is achieved in this way. And then,
but is M produced by spontaneous breaking of scale symmetry?
Yeah. So it would be, you would have to have the terms like MCN, some Yukawa coupling at times so high, very high
will be
very, very small number.
Exponentially tiny.
Yeah, 10 to the minus 18 or so.
So, okay, so extremely fine to introduce neutrino masses.
Well, the word fine-tuning is used in different in different definitions.
Just
small number. Okay. Yeah.
You have to introduce a very tiny number.
And that's not the only one. This another one is ratio of the Higgs mass to W mass, which has to be introduced in any event, and which is part of
Higgs mass to the Planck
mass, yes, which is part of the picture.